Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast with me, Sam Harris, your host. I invite fascinating humans from all walks of life to share their wisdom and unpack their mindsets and formulas for growth. Hello and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today, I am very excited to be joined by a badass mother... can't say that part of the word. And he is a bit of a legend. He runs a great show called The Jim Rutt Show. So you'll be surprised to know that he's also called Jim Rutt. And on the show, he goes into some really interesting topics on consciousness, like the state of social media, like the where the world's going, modernity, and like just like really deep, interesting things with amazing experts. And I was on that show. He was the CEO of Network Solutions as he kind of came in, turned it around, managed to sell it, did a great job, and started a bunch of different businesses as well during his career. And just a really fascinating guy who I'm super happy to have on the show.
Well, thanks, Sam. Great to be here. You know, I'm game to talk about almost anything. So what do you want to talk about?
You do enjoy going into consciousness a lot, and so do I. What would you say is, because you've had a number of leading experts on consciousness on your show, and what would you say have been like the biggest sort of mind-blowing insights that you felt to understand? And like, I've got so many questions, and I'm just going to stop myself by leaving it at that.
Let me lay out my view on consciousness, actually, which doesn't correspond to any of the experts exactly, sure, but takes bits and pieces from various others. Actually, the expert I'm closest to is, in the philosophical sense, is John Searle. And his view is very much a materialist one, biological, which is consciousness as you and I manifest it. At least I do, I suspect, but I'm not sure, right? Yeah, you could be a zombie, I don't know. But assuming you're not, there, he does actually a very good job of dismantling the concept of the philosopher zombie. But anyway, assuming we're both conscious, we are conscious because we are animal, right? And that consciousness is something that has evolved in our particular animal lines. Searle and the other Searleans would say probably at least back to reptiles and possibly amphibians, that it is an important part of our cognitive architecture, though only a part, right? When you study cognitive neuroscience and cognitive science, you do it seriously, you realize that, you know, the vast preponderance of the processing in the brain is in the unconscious. Things like perception, even things like talking. And when you and I are talking, we do not consciously form our words. Try doing it sometime, and you'll find that you can hardly speak, right? So in my view, and in Searle's and people of this school, you know, consciousness is a biological phenomenon that's energetically expensive. It uses, you know, maybe 20% of the brain, probably even more expensive than that in terms of genetic information, because the organizations within the brain to support consciousness are probably substantial because of its peculiar nature. It's not a simple thing. And it's, while a relatively small part of the total brain processing, a critical part of our cognitive architecture, and is why it's been selected for by evolution. And so, to say the least, my perspective on consciousness is very non-woo. An analog to our consciousness, an important part of their cognitive architecture, energetically expensive to maintain, and is part of how they make their living. That's basically where I start from. I then spend some time trying to think through, why is it that we have what seems like this movie running in our head, that, of which we are the main first-person character? And, you know, I've come around to at least a tentative conclusion in terms of the how. The how is that because that what we really are a whole series of memories that operate on different time scales. We have perceptual memory. When you're seeing something, a scene, those resonances in your visual system are stored close to the rest of the visual system for something on the order of 80 milliseconds, you know, a bit less than a tenth of a second. And if you want to do a test, turn your head away real quickly from something you're looking at, and the after image will still persist for on the order of a tenth of a second. You have to do it quickly because a tenth of a second ain't very long. And that turns out to be really, really important for, you know, stabilizing, you know, things like consciousness. We then have short-term working memory, the famous 7 ± 2. The reason phone numbers used to have 7 digits, because that's about what you can keep in your working memory. That lasts for a second or so, or two or three. And if you rehearse it, means when you look at a phone number, you want to remember it long enough to get to the phone. What do? You say it over and over in your head until it's kind of locked in. You know, a few seconds, you know, which is there. And then we have your short-term memory stored in the hippocampus, you know, thinking about what did you do earlier this morning? You can remember that fairly easily. But But most people have some difficulty remembering what they had for breakfast 5 days ago, because the short-term memory has been expunged. Unless it was something particularly memorable or you made a conscious decision to remember it, it probably didn't get written to your long-term memory. You know, lots of stuff gets written to your long-term memory, but not everything. And it's typically written, I believe it's written into the short-term memory and the long-term memory in the form of what's called episodes, episodic memory. So these are various periods of what you're experiencing are then substantially reduced in detail and then stored. The boundaries are between, I think there's two classes of boundaries. One is the perceptual boundary. So when you walk from one room to another, brain is always predicting what it's going to see next, right? And if I'm sitting here looking at you, my brain is generally pretty accurate in what it's predicting, right? When I walk from one room to another for a short period of time, its predictions all go to shit, right? It's making predictions about this room, and then the next room, it's not making predictions. So during that period when the predictions go to shit, I believe it terminates one low-level episode and starts another. And then these lower-level episodes are stacked up in a higher-level construct around goal fulfillment. The global workspace theory, Bernard Bars, Stanislaus Dehaene, he's also been a person that works in the field of the global workspace theory, which says that we have, you know, this thing that seems like the movie that we're in is actually a global set of activations that let the whole brain know about what are the current conscious content. And the conscious contents are the objects that your perceptual system have extracted from the environment. Since I'm sitting here in front of my microphone, that's one object. Or I have a pen sitting in front of me, a piece of paper, the screen, your beautiful face there on the screen, a little blurry today because you have low bandwidth, etc. All these are separate objects that are in this global workspace. And by the way, recently activated memories, including long-term memories, contents of working memory are conscious contents. Those perceptual memories that last for a tenth of a second, they're accessible, probably. And think about those sitting in the global workspace. And then this is where it gets really interesting. This is where I'm starting to my theory starts to come together. Attention is the key to consciousness. Lots and lots and lots of lab experiments show that we can actually attend to only exactly one thing at a time. You think you're multitasking, you're not. You're time sharing, right? You are moving rapidly from one thing to another. Some really elegant lab experiments prove this to a fairly well. And so how do we decide what to attend to? Well, I would argue that our memories are voting in real time on what to attend to next. The lab psychologist experiments seem to indicate that our attentional switching happens on the time scale of a quarter of a second. About every quarter of a second, your brain makes the decision to continue to attending to what it's currently attending to or to switch to something else. And that's based, I would argue, most of the time on votes from your unconscious memory parts of your mind. And so it turns out it's very important to what your experiences are in life, because your experiences in life significantly define what the cursor of consciousness is as your attention hops from one thing to another on a time frame from, at the shortest, about a quarter of a second, to the longest, 3, 4, 5 seconds. We all know that trying to pay attention to something for a long period of time is actually difficult, right? I want to stare at that little figure above the screen here on your application. My brain gets tired. You know, I think there's actually an algorithm that says the longer I've been paying attention to something, the more likely I am to switch away from it. And so it takes a smaller vote from the memories to say, nah, I don't want to look at that anymore. Let me go look at my own face. Aren't I a pretty boy this morning? So that's a key part of it. Second, third, fourth, each object has associated with it affordances, which are things that you can do with it. At a minimum, every object has, at least every material object, has approach or avoid as affordances. So I see a pen down here on my desk. I can approach it. I can reach out for it. Now, it turns out pens have the affordance of grab. They're grabbable. They're a shape that's grabbable, and they fit my hand. So one of the affordances that we learn gradually as children is that a pen has the affordance of grab it, so I can pick it up. Then, as we start going to school, we have other affordances for the pen, like, oh, I can write on this little piece of paper here, right? And there's also votes, shall we say, in the brain that says, all right, when I'm paying attention to my pen, one of the affordances is to grab it. Something in the unconscious says, grab it. Or your conscious can also sort of direct it, that we now believe that the decision is made to grab your pen before your consciousness even knows it, the so-called Leibniz effect. So the relationship between the unconscious mind and the conscious mind, not what it seems, right? Much more of it's happening in the unconscious mind. And in some sense, the conscious mind is where the reports are given and where the movie is then shown. The actual directors are, an awful lot of it are in the unconscious mind. life is an emergent phenomena of chemistry and physics, and confident, though it's always possible that I'm wrong, that we will realize relatively soon, 10, 20, 30 years, that consciousness is an emergent phenomena of life. There is, you know, there's nothing woo or magical or anything else. It's scientifically describable. It has to do with these couplings of memory on various time frames. They're voting on the activity of the cursor of consciousness in the global workspace of objects. And oh, by the way, what makes humans different than chimps? And the answer is probably not a whole lot, except that we have a new class of conscious contents, which is symbols. One of the most underrated books, a book called The Symbolic Species by Terence Deacon, lays this out in exquisite detail. And he shows that surprisingly large amount of we think it's human cognition, chimps can do too, monkeys even, rats to a substantial degree. But what none of them can do fluidly is to manipulate symbols. And so he hypothesized that humans have a new circuit that we evolve to allow us to deal with symbols. And so a symbol is nothing but an abstract name attached to any object, right? So I call this thing my microphone. I could call it my blibbity-gibbet. It wouldn't really matter. That would be a symbol. And symbols are way easier to manipulate than objects. Further, symbols can be organized with syntax, and that may have happened later in humans. It's one argument now that we developed symbols 200,000 or 300,000 years ago, but we didn't really develop syntax, which is how to use them in complex forms like we call language, until maybe 40 or 50,000 years ago, when we suddenly see this flourishing of culture that exploded around that time. And so this architecture of consciousness that I'm working on applies equally to your dog, a chimp, and yourself. And the principal differences are that humans have symbols. Oh, by the way, dogs have some stuff we don't have. Vastly bigger olfactory, smelling. You know, they see a world of smells that we can't even make any sense of. And of course, there's the famous philosophy paper, What's It Like to Be a Bat? Thomas Nagel writes about what's the consciousness of a bat like? Because they, of course, use a sense that we don't even have, which is echolocation, certainly a kind of sonar to navigate in the nighttime to, you know, fly around without running into trees and what have you. And that's another class of conscious content in the Ruttian model of consciousness that makes bats' consciousness as different from ours as ours is from chimps, probably.
Yeah. It's very hard to control the contents of your consciousness, but I think that is where mindsets kind of come in, and they dictate how your attitude is towards the world and what how you respond to it, and then what the contents of your consciousness are is like how you are feeling and what you think, whether you're positive towards something, whether you're not, and then so everything that happens.
2021 is looking up. If part of your strategy for your team is to add new members, then LinkedIn Jobs could be the right place for you to find someone quickly, and your first job post is free. LinkedIn's active community of professionals has more than 722 million members worldwide. Getting started is easier than ever, whereas saying the word started, quite challenging when you're me, apparently. But yes, you can get started on LinkedIn very quickly and just find people super fast with targeted job campaigns and screening questions. It just makes hiring a breeze, and you can do it all from your mobile device. And I'd really recommend it for like managing your job posts and candidates and stuff. It's a very simple place, all done at linkedin.com. So if your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. And now you can post a job for free. Just visit linkedin.com/growth. Again, that is linkedin.com/growth to post a job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
So have you had any thoughts around like how to then better control like what's going on in your consciousness? Because it's just like this unwieldy beast and there's so much going on that you don't even realize.
Well, yeah, one thing I didn't go into is the very, very important aspect of emotional valences. Every episode that's recorded, when I talk about the various hierarchies of episodic memories, is tagged with an emotional valence in multiple dimensions. You know, was it good or bad or uplifting or depressing or fascinating or boring? You know, so I think, you know, 6 or 7 dimensions like that. But also, what was the magnitude? And so the higher the emotional valence, good or bad, the more likely it, or the bigger vote it has on your being in the future. And so if you want to tune yourself, it's useful to have a number of useful memories that have high emotional valence associated with them. So try to engage with your life so that you have a, you know, you're not just one of these bland level people, but but rather you oscillate a fair bit in your emotional state as you go through your day. And in particular, you try to put positive valences on things that are productive so that those things will get positive upvotes in your consciousness, you know, as you go through the day. I think that's an important thing. And oh, by the way, you can modify these things a little bit. This is one of the treatments for PTSD. You can actually access a memory. You can change the emotional valence on it. Remember that time you asked the girl to the dance and she laughed in your fucking face and you felt like shit? Well, you can pull that memory up and turn it into a funny memory. Right? Think about it. Yeah, that was actually pretty fucking funny. I was a clown of misery, right? That's ha ha ha. And literally laugh out loud. It'll literally rewrite partially the emotional valence of that event. And so that event, instead of being a downer and voting, don't talk to girls, it'll actually say, oh yeah, you know, it was pretty fucked up, but it was kind of funny. So what the hell, right? So you can literally reprogram your memories. And there's a growing amount of evidence that there's a drug called MDMA. Also known as ecstasy or Molly, that can really help you reprogram memories. Now, don't do this at home, children, without adult supervision, but there's a growing amount of scientific evidence that using MDMA, you know, therapeutic setting, can allow one to have easier access to changing the emotional valences of past memories, which might be causing you a bummer. And, you know, PTSD is probably, you know, one of the strongest and worst post-traumatic stress disorder. Stress disorder. So, but yeah, you can do it yourself without your MDMA. And probably in the future, as we learn more about this, we may actually use it just to deal with the normal bad memories, not just the really extreme PTSD ones. So yeah, work to reprogram your bad memories or just suppress the motherfuckers. I know the people say, oh, don't denial. You know, I'm a great believer. In fucked up shit. Put it in a box and bury it in a fucking basement. Never think about it again. Don't let it have a vote. Some people tell you that's really bad, but I think it actually is not a bad thing. Because the more you revisit a memory, the stronger it will get, or the more vote it will have. So suppression and denial has its places as well, I would say. One is to try to control the flow of attention. Your unconscious is chattering away at you and trying to drive it in various ways. And you sort of want to let it to do that, but you also want to choose what you pay attention to and for how long, and not let your brain pull you away from attention. And we talked about this yesterday on your podcast. That fucking phone is the worst offender. It wants to suck your attention over to it. It's the greediest, most jealous little piece of shit ever heard. And doing things to not let it suck your attention away is key. You know, worship your attention as who you are. In fact, what I like to say is that attention is the cursor of consciousness, kind of like the cursor on the computer screen. And as you follow your attention, that's who you are. So take your attention very, very seriously. Anyone who's hijacking your attention in bad ways, any things that are hijacking your attention in bad ways, get them out of your life or downregulate them or something. Because there's nothing more precious than your attention. I think that's the biggest takeaway that all children can do at home, with or without adult supervision, is to not let things that you don't want to let hijack your attention, because you are your attention, quite literally, plus the memories that are then generated, which then cycle back, right? If you're controlling your attention and you have memories that are productive and good, then those memories will be voting on your future attentions, and they'll be constructive and good also, at least they're more likely to be. Protect your attention like you protect the family jewels.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps. For a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.